A few months ago, I was in Israel, and there's some friends of mine who are Ayurvedic teachers, and they're from the Druze tradition, and they teach in Nazareth. How many of you have been to Nazareth? Only one person. Yeah. So they mostly teach a group of people who are, everyone is Arabs basically, and in this Arab group there was about 40 when I came the night that I came from my presentation, and about half of them were Christian, and the other half were Muslim. And the topic that they gave me to speak on was a typical topic that everyone is concerned about, how to deal with the difficulties of life, how to deal with the miseries of life. It doesn't make a difference whether one's an atheist or a Christian or a Hindu or a Jew or a Muslim. Everyone has to deal with this very, very, very difficult issue. But here I was in this situation. I was just like this, and I was trying to think of how could I explain this, what I wanted to say, the truths that I had from the Srimad Bhagavatam, from this very, very ancient book, in such a way that people wouldn't think it's sort of just another religion. And I already have my religion. And there were ladies in hijabs there, and it was quite an interesting situation. And I was trying to think, how in the world am I going to present this in such a way that people immediately don't set up 1,000 defenses against this and think that this is something very foreign? Because in fact, truth is truth, and regardless of the culture and tradition that it's presented in, truth is truth, and it's going to be true in every situation, although the language may be a little different, or although the cultural presentation may be a bit different and the circumstances may be different. But truth is truth. I was convinced about that. So I started explaining it, and everyone was very polite, and after I said to my friends, I said, was that okay? Because I was wondering, because I wasn't really sure what people were thinking, because everyone, they were very cultured and very nice people, but I personally wasn't satisfied. Because how to explain this? It was awkward because I didn't want to talk about Krishna too much, you know, use the word Krishna, because they were all Muslims and Christians, so I didn't know what they were going to think. So I used the word God a lot, and I used the word sometimes Krishna said, or this and that. But I wasn't quite satisfied because I really couldn't tell the story, what I wanted to say, exactly the way I wanted to say it. And then later on I was thinking, how in the world can I do this, make a similar presentation, and I'll see how we do today. And then I was thinking maybe I'll be invited there next year. And maybe I'll try to do the same thing again in a slightly different way, because the issue that we're all, that so many difficulties follow us, it doesn't change from last year to this year. It's just something that is continuous in this world. So I knew that the people would still be there with the same question. And I thought of a way to present it, and there were two poor parts, and I'm going to explain it to you what I was considering and what I am considering. First part of the presentation is I said, tell it the same truth in a story, because everyone likes a good story. And the story is where I got the truth from anyway. It's from the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the story of one very saintly person named Narada Muni, and how he became a saintly person. Yes, it's possible to become a saintly person, and this is really the challenge of life. And it's easy to wish we met a, you know, a great, great, super holy person and who will solve all our problems. But the real issue and is that we have to become saintly to actually solve our problems. So I wanted to tell that story. And the second point is what I wanted to say to you all also, is because I've been a member of the Hare Krishna tradition for 50 years now. When I was 21, I began chanting Hare Krishna, and I took initiation from my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada. And so naturally, the terminology I use, the language I use, and the culture that surrounds what I'm going to say is naturally the culture of the Hare Krishna tradition. So what I would like you to do, because some of you are very familiar with the Hare Krishna tradition, some of you are familiar with all the language and the words and the persons, and some of you aren't, and some of you just have different concepts than the exact ones I'm going to present. But yet, I firmly believe that truth is truth. So if the truth, as I explain it, in the language and the cultural wrappings that I serve, and the tradition that I explain it in now, if it doesn't exactly fit into the wrappings and cultural tradition and language that you are familiar with, I request you to please just translate it. Translate it into the language and culture and the terms that you are familiar with, and let that same truth come through and nourish your own journey to saintliness. Isn't that an odd thought? Is that we're supposed to be the saints. We're supposed to become very, very, very deep. And what that because depth is the only thing that's going to pull us through the difficulties of life. You know, we can parrot something we've heard somewhere, and you know, something that we think is true or even believe is true, but when the cyclone of fate hits us, as it sometimes, and it must hit us at different points of our life. It must hit us. This is something that we have to accept, that you know, that it's going to, these things happen. And if at no other time, at the time of death, it's certainly going to happen, where things are basically out of control. And then at those times, raise your hand if you've... No, I won't ask the question. Because there's two ways to ask the question, and I won't ask either of them. One way is, how many of you have ever been in a circumstance that was so difficult, it was completely out of your control, and your mind was so disturbed? That's one way to ask it. The other way to ask it is, how many of you have never been in the circumstance where... In both cases, probably no one would ever admit to never being in that circumstance. I know some of you quite well in the circumstances you've been in, and myself too. So the point is, unless we actually become deep, then all the stories and all the traditions and all the... there's a limit to how much it's going to help. Yes, we should hear it, and yes, we should understand it, and yes, we should know it deeply. But really, the biggest yes and the biggest challenge is applying it. So we will speak about that point later on, even today. I wanted to start. Is this going to work by me doing it or by you doing it? Yes. I accept it, so I like that picture so much. That's COVID on Hill. Now, which one are we going to have? What are you putting on first? Yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes. See, I was thinking, Again, just press that one. And let me see if this even works. Let's see if... Yes, one story, four truths. Let's see if I push this little button. Anything happens? No. We have to turn it on first. Oh, never mind. You push the next little button. I wanted to start by speaking about... again, next one. Presuppositions. I don't know if you're familiar with this term, but a presupposition, it's a philosophical term, it's a psychological term, it's a practical term. It means that which is supposed, that which we assume is true. But it may be true or may not be true, but we assume it's true. And we're often unconscious of the very prepositions that we assume to be true in our own lives. And we gather these presuppositions very, very early in our life, generally. And we pick them up also later on. There's one thing I wanted to say also, that because I've asked you to translate everything into your own terminology, if this, or conceptions, or if there's something not clear or anything like that, so you're free to just raise your hand at any time. That would probably be easier for me than just calling out a question or anything. But if you have a question at any time, just raise your hand. And if it doesn't really interrupt the flow of what I'm saying, I'll try my best to answer it. So a presupposition is something that we have in our mind that underlies the way we think and our search for happiness. And we're not usually even aware of it. We're just being pushed by life. We're pushed by our desires. And we're not aware of these presuppositions that are underlying our life. I thought of a few examples. One is, and our search for happiness is underlined by these presuppositions. And we think that everyone accepts the same things that we do, but everyone doesn't. We're just presupposing or assuming that's true. So there's a famous story of how when Bill Gates, who is the founder of Microsoft, everyone knows famous Bill Gates, when he was growing up, his parents, who were very highly educated individuals and they were in the world, they used to play a game with the children around the table, and they would have the children argue with each other or put forward thoughts, and if you lost, if one of the child who lost would have to pay a fine. You'd have to pay some money if you lost the argument or the debate, and the one who won got wealth. Now what if you're growing up and that's what's going around in your around your breakfast table and dinner table? Now that's going to do something to your consciousness. And that's going to place in your consciousness thoughts about what happiness is, what's valuable, what's not valuable, and what's dangerous. And you're not even aware of it. And you think, well, this is how everyone's growing up because this is all you know. So that's one example of that. Now, a second example is who was his great competitor?
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs, right. So he was brought up in a completely different circumstance. He was an orphan. He was adopted by his step-parents. And there was one condition in the adoption that this boy had to go to university. They had to promise that they would send him to the university. So he actually grew up, and he was quite the hippie for a while. And he explained in one lecture at Stanford University that he was so poor when he went to the university, and he didn't like the university at all. He ended up dropping out. And he couldn't practically afford to feed himself. And he would look forward to the one good meal a week that he would get at the Hare Krishna temple on Sundays in Seattle. So just the fact that you're orphan, you grow up without your natural biological parents. Now that's going to make you feel rejected naturally. I mean, generally speaking, and then you have to really prove that you're worthy. So there, and so the so Steve Jobs is born, who's such a heavy competitor and a heavy he was until he left this world. So I have to prove myself that I'm worthy. So that becomes a part of the psychology. And even today, as I was riding my bicycle early in the morning at the local park, Whiteman Park, I was on my bicycle, and because it was Saturday, there was a lot of families around, and there was a lot of them, they take their young boys and their young girls out for rides on their bicycle. So I was riding on my big bicycle, and there was a little boy riding on his little bicycle. He was like maybe 4 years old or something like that. And I went very carefully powering past him, and he just looked at my bicycle, and then he looked at his bicycle, which was very little. He said, "Big bicycles are so much better." So then when they don't understand how hard I have to pedal. So that concept, you know, the bigger is better, is in this little boy's mind. And then after he gets his bigger bicycle, after his little bicycle, get a bigger bicycle, then he'll see someone on a motorcycle, and he thinks, motorcycle is always better. And then one car, and then the next car, and then he gets his helicopter, and then he gets his jet plane. So it's presuppositions. Bigger is better. I have to prove myself. These things push us. Now, we're not going to have a class on psychology where I ask all of you to examine the presuppositions that are pushing you in your life. They're very, very, very deep, though. They're very, very deep. But they basically push us in two different directions. They push us and pull us. They push us to what we think happiness is going to be, either really succeeding monetarily or this or that, or becoming famous or becoming powerful, or becoming very learned, or getting a PhD or a triple PhD, or being the controller of a corporation or a country or the whole world. Usually they manifest in two ways, practically speaking. One is you want to pull something closer to you, and that thing that you want to pull closer to you is something that you're thinking is going to bring you the happiness that you want based on the presuppositions that are governing your life. And then the second thing, what was the first thing? His first examination. What was the first thing?
The bike.
You want it. You want it. Something that I want that's going to bring me happiness. Practically speaking, you're imagining it's going to bring you happiness. But I want it. And I want to bring that closer. And then secondarily, there's the push. There's the pull. I want this closer. And the things that are standing in the way of my happiness, based on the presuppositions of my life, I want to push away. I want to move this way. I move that way. Whether it's an enemy or someone who has a different view than me, or someone who doesn't agree with me, or someone who doesn't get along with me, or this problem or that, I want to move it. Now, there's in psychology, there's one particular type of psychology, if I remember correctly, it's called brief therapy, solution focused. Brief solution-focused therapy, and it's and they have a question they call the miracle question in the psychology, and it's an interesting one to do, to ask yourself, where the person asks the client, the therapist asks the client, if a miracle happened, boing, and the next morning, tomorrow morning, you woke up and your life was transformed. The things that you didn't want to be there weren't there. and the things that you did want to be there were there. And then they ask him, what would your life look like? I'm pausing now so you all have the time to play with the miracle question. What would your life look like if basically you had everything that you dreamed was going to make you happy, and everything that you dream is the cause of your misery was removed? What would your life look like? Well, one thing you can be sure of, if that came true, if the miracle did in fact happen, it wouldn't look like you imagined it's going to look like. Some other problem would somehow come up, and the solution that you thought was going to solve all your problems automatically brings another problem. Because happiness, true happiness, doesn't take place on the level that we're imagining true happiness is taking place on. It really occurs on a completely different level. Now, this is something very difficult to accept, because we've invested so many years of our life, our thoughts, our desires, our hopes, our education, our finances, we've invested everything, basically speaking, into placing our hope in one particular situation. So we have a vested interest, and to pull ourselves from that and say that was really a mistake, it was foolish, almost no one is ready to do that unless somehow or another someone is blessed with the curse of a great disaster in life, and then everything, all our dreams, they turn into what they really are made out of, and they are made out of smoke, basically a projection on smoke. What you can, like if we had, instead of a screen here, if we had some smoke. Next time we should light a fire here and have some smoke coming out. It would be really a graphic. And then we take a locomotive, a movie of a locomotive, a train, and it's coming down here. And then maybe we all get frightened, and it's making its locomotive sound, and these are the tracks. But it's not real. It's just that it's projected on smoke. It's a projection of our mind, basically. So our hopes and aspirations, if they are just based on the presuppositions that somehow we've gathered in this life or in previous lives, if that's what our whole life is based on, there's going to come different points of our life where we see that it really didn't have substance at all, even though we're aware that it hasn't delivered the happiness to us the whole time. But we're dreaming that if I just move this out of the way, if I just pull this a little closer, then I'm going to get what I'm really, the inner, the true happiness that I've been longing for and chasing after, and even praying for. That's a dream, because it's on the wrong level. So to help us move from the dream to reality, we're going to turn to the wisdom of this ancient text, the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the basic story we're going to hear is from the first canto, the first part of the Bhagavatam, but it has its roots, its beginning, in the seventh canto. In the seventh canto, we're going to hear, we are hearing right now, as we speak, about one person who was named Upabharana. And Upabharana, what in the Sanskrit language was a Gandharva. A Gandharva is someone like a higher being, who's born with a perfection. A perfection, like you see this sometimes, we hear about them if we don't see them. Like Mozart, the famous composer, he composed his first symphony when he was 7 years old. A full symphony. Now, what were you doing when you were 7 years old? A full symphony. So some people, due to their in Sanskrit the word is purva sanskaras, they're born carrying something from a previous life that give them these amazing abilities, miraculous abilities. So he was beautiful. Perfectly formed, beautiful. And he could sing like a Gandhava, like an angel, basically. He could sing so sweetly. And as he describes himself, I had a beautiful face and a pleasing... Oh, we need a violin player for this one. And an attractive bodily structure. I was decorated with flower garlands and I had sandalwood upon pulp upon my forehead. And I was most pleasing to the women of my city. Thus, I was bewildered, always feeling the desires of how I could enjoy and how I could manipulate, basically, how I could use my gifts, my blessings, how I can use my blessings for my pleasure. And he says specifically, I was bewildered because everyone was attracted to him. And once, he explains, there was a Sankirtan festival, and the exact words used in the Sanskrit, Ekada Deva Satya, between the higher beings, once, Gandhava Apsparagana, all the people of my categories, the men and ladies in my higher being group, were invited to a ceremony, Upahuta Vishra Srigbhya Hari Kata Upagayanai. There was an occasion where everyone would glorify Harikatha. They would glorify the Supreme Absolute Truth. Hari, the Supreme Absolute Truth. They would glorify the Supreme Absolute Truth. And he was invited to this event. Being invited to that festival, so again, the purpose of the festival was to glorify and speak about the Supreme Absolute Truth. Being invited to that festival, Upabharana, continued to speak, I also joined. And surrounded by beautiful women, I began musically singing other songs, not in glorification of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Now, because of this, because of my going against the actual purpose, two purposes, one of this specific festival, because I went directly against the purpose of this festival, and secondarily, I went against the perfection of my gift. So the heads of the festival, who are very clear-thinking and pure-hearted, they became angry at him and they cursed him. And the words spoken by powerful people, they can actually cause us to blossom or they can cause us to go down. So they cursed him. They were angry. They cursed him and said, because you have gone against the purpose of this ceremony, this sacrifice, this gathering, immediately you will lose your qualities, your good qualities, your blessings. You have misused your blessings. You will lose them and take your next birth devoid of beauty. and fortune. Now, there's, oh, let's move to the next one. The next one should be blank. If technology is, yes, it's blank. Okay. He was cursed. He had a blessing, and he was cursed. He used his blessing improperly, and the curse was basically he lost it. And what I've seen is that everyone has blessings. You know, when we look at other people, I remember when I was growing up, when I was in my teenage years, I had some friends. I used to have hair then, by the way. I had some friends who had blonde hair, and I didn't. And my hair was curly. I wanted it to be straight. When I look back on it, it's you know, teenager stuff, but you know, how many hours you sit in front of, stand in front of a mirror trying to straighten your curly hair, or what do you do to make it blonde? Of course you dye it, but you didn't do that in those days. But what are you doing? Is you try and try again to become something you're not, even though you have your own blessings. It never feels enough, because it's the same point, that the real blessing, the real happiness doesn't come from this level, even though we're expecting the happiness to come from this very superficial, on the surface level. So, and then if we happen to have a blessing that's in vogue at the moment, that people look at as really, that's really wonderful, then we become proud. And that pride causes us two things which are opposed to each other in one sense. It causes us to be very selfish, so we want to, now let me use my blessing in such a way that I can enjoy myself. I'm very self-centered. I use my blessing in a self-centered way. And I've also seen that even if you try to use your blessing in service to the Supreme Absolute Truth, just like Narada Upabahana was requested to do, still there's such a tendency to want to get something for me. At least let me take some credit. You know, we want everyone to at least notice and praise us for how unselfish we are, or whatever. So that's always the tendency, as long as our desires stay on this superficial, material level. There'll always be a tendency to want to take something for oneself. You have to upasaka, that is the Sanskrit for this. And then the second thing is fear. Our blessing causes us fear. Why?
Lose it?
Well, okay, you're afraid of losing it, but what else are we afraid of?
Someone will be better than us.
Yes, that someone has a bit of a better blessing than we have, and therefore we're always afraid, and we want to push them away or criticize them subtly, and we fear them. So this pride is an unbalanced emotion that comes accompanied with by fear, and it's always trying to support itself, not letting everyone else know, and even ourselves know, that that it's covering a hollowness within us, a hollowness and emptiness within us. So, there's one story that I once heard about. There was one sadhu who was soon to leave, one holy person, a saintly person who was soon to die, and he called his students nearby, and he said, when I go to the judge, when I leave this world, they'll call me in front of the judge, and they'll type my name into the database, and then they'll call my records up, and they'll say, is it true that you did this? And I'll have to say, yeah, I did do that. But there'll always be a but after that. But here's the reason I did it. What else could I do? You know, this happened and this happened and this happened. What else can I do? And say, okay, next record. Is it true that you did this? Well, yeah, I did do that, but what else could I do? This happened and this happened and this happened and that happened. And then one by one, they go through all the inappropriatenesses of my life, and I'll have an excuse for each and every one of them. But then, he said, they'll ask me, you know yourself better than anyone knows you. Why were you so proud? And then this saintly person said, when he asks me that, I will hang my head down and I will not be able to say anything. So, upabharana. Was cursed to take his next birth. And he lost everything. He lost everything. He took his birth in a poor family. He didn't even know who his father was. He didn't have a father, and his mother couldn't even tell him who his father was. And she was just a servant in like a hotel where people stayed. A motel where people stayed for some days or some months and then moved on. And she was just a servant in that hotel. And he was just a poor boy. Now we go to the next one. Here's the first truth that I wanted to say, the first of four. The root cause of our current suffering is difficult to discern, and therefore complicated to dissolve. Why we're in the particular situation we're in, with its combination of blessings and curses, difficulties, strengths, weaknesses. We try to move the problems out of the way. We try to bring the causes of our happiness closer. But it never seems, our attempts never seem to get us where we want to be. And we live with the anticipation that in the future it will happen. Why? Why is it so difficult to remove these? To get the happiness? Or to remove the miseries and remove the difficulties? Because we can't really figure out what the root is, the causes. So in the example of upabharana, and he took his next birth as Narada Muni, in that example, he's trying to solve his poverty problem. He has an absentee father. He doesn't know where his father is. There's this problem, that problem. And you try naturally to solve those problems, whatever our problems, difficulties are, but where did it begin? We try to solve deep, deep issues on a superficial platform, and naturally we're not going to be successful. We can't be successful because the level we're trying to solve it on isn't the level where the problem truly exists. That's one thing we can learn from the story of Upabharana. Now, when he took his birth as Narada Muni, this is actually before he was Narada Muni. It's not mentioned in the Bhagavatam what his name was. But he was just like a 5-year-old boy, and he was penniless. His mother was just serving, and he just had some cleaning and washing pots and washing people's clothes. She didn't own the hotel, the motel, or whatever it was. She was just a servant there, no father. So we would, no money, no education. So we would think, what is this boy's future? He's so unfortunate. But one of the arts of life, and I can say that this is one of the most important arts of life to learn, and we shall speak about this, is how to turn the curse into a blessing. How to turn the difficulty into a source of great strength and a source of greatness, even of purity, of saintliness. But we can't approach these things thinking that it's easily done, because deep things, one has to be deep to deal with them. There's a famous little story that I've heard so many times and told so many times about these two twin boys who were sons of a father who was an alcoholic. So one of them turned out to be an alcoholic, and the other turned out to be a famous, successful brain surgeon. So someone asked the boy who turned out to be an alcoholic, why did you become like this? Why did you become an alcoholic? How did it happen to you? And his response was, with a father like that, what else could I become? And then they asked the brain surgeon, how did you become the successful brain surgeon? And he said, with a father like that, what else could I become? So how to deal with the difficulties of life in such a way that the curse becomes a blessing, the difficulty becomes the cause of success, is what we wish to speak about. And again, it's a very deep topic that needs being applied to the deepest level, to the core of our being, if we want to be able to do it perfectly and successfully. So Narada Muni, he was born of a maidservant. This is from the first canto of the Bhagavatam. Engaged in the service of brahmanas, that means the priests and learned scholars who were following the principles of Vedanta. So he was just a servant there. And when they were living together during the 4 months of the rainy season, in India, there's a period of time which we're in right now, which is called Chaturmasi, which literally means 4 months when it's raining. And people who travel continuously, the saintly persons who travel continuously so that they develop detachment. Because why, if you're traveling continuously, why does that force you to be detached? It's because everything that you're attached to, you have to carry with you. And if you have to physically carry it with you, gradually the amount that you're attached to lessens and lessens and lessens until you just are carrying what you need, the essentials of what you actually need. So they would travel, and it's a tradition that you see even today in India. Sadhus, saintly persons, they travel and travel and travel. And then during the rainy season, one can't travel. because of the rains, of the mud, the bridges, the rivers are all over flooded, etc. So at that time, they would stay in one place for these 4 months, chaturmasya, 4 months, and they would be very, very focused at that time. So at that time, they wouldn't build up any further attachment. So he was there, and so some bhakti vedantas, some very saintly, holy people, they came to the place where Narada Muni was staying, the boy was staying, and they were living together in the 4 months of the rainy season, and he was a little boy, and he took care of them. Naturally, because he had some good qualities, and soon we'll hear about the good qualities that he had. So he served, and here is one of the keys, one of the main keys in turning difficulties into blessings, and turning and removing the pride that so deeply controls my heart. Removing that is serve. Seva, serve. Serve. Use your blessing to serve. Who should we serve? We should serve everyone, basically. Serve. We should serve. We should serve. So Narada Muni was innocent, and it was natural. In the days before mobile phone games, when instead of serving people are killing, shooting their enemies and knocking them out and gaining strength from that, it's just natural for a child to serve. It's just, in fact, it's actually natural for everyone to serve. It's completely unnatural to think myself, the master, and that I'm the one who should be served. Now, I can prove to you that it's unnatural to think that you're the one who should be served. And that is, you ask yourself, how many people in your whole life, other than your mothers, maybe, have you been able to convince that you should be the one who served? We can't convince anyone that we're the center and that we should be served. It's unnatural. It's unrealistic. It's not practical. It's illusion. But if you serve with a desire to please, then something miraculous happens. Everyone wants to serve you. Their hearts are melted by your heart. But that's a different topic than I wanted to, worth going into right now. It's worth going into, but time will prohibit us from going into that deeply. So he was, there were saintly persons, and the culture and the naturalness of the boy. He was a simple boy, and it's simple, just like children. Young children naturally don't want to eat meat and things like that. The parents in a meat-eating society, they have to force the children, practically speaking. So similarly, it's natural for children to want to serve, to want to serve. So he had the great fortune of serving holy people in a simple way. Please get this, please wash this, please bring this. Could you do that? And he was happy to do it. And they naturally, when someone serves, naturally the heart melts. When someone wants to force you to serve them, then naturally one defends. Blockages come up in the heart. But when someone wants to, who serves in a good-hearted way, naturally the heart melts. Naturally the heart melts. And you want to reciprocate. So these holy people, whose hearts were naturally soft, naturally soft, naturally wanted to reciprocate with this little boy who was the servant in such a simple, innocent way. And the first thing they did was they blessed him. They desired his welfare. They desired his betterment. They became inclined to him. And this is a great fortune when saintly persons become inclined to us. So they blessed him by their causeless mercy. Now it's interesting, he did his part, which was serve, and it, later we'll just hear soon about his qualities, what a good boy he was. But you can't force a saintly person to bless you, to really sincerely desire your welfare. It can't be forced. It comes from them. It has to come from their desire, causeless desire. It comes from their individual nature, from their well-wishing. And you can't say, well, I've done this, now you have to bless me. It just doesn't work like that. Because then it's business. I've done this, and now I want the blessings. And it just doesn't work like that. Because naturally it's perceived as business. But when one simply and naturally serves, as this boy did, then naturally these kind-hearted persons who are soft-hearted, who are saintly, they blessed him. But what was his qualities that he brought? He was self-controlled. He didn't have any attachment for sports, even though he was a boy. And he wasn't naughty, and he wasn't talkative either. So he was very well-behaved. And then one time, he asked their permission, and there was some after they had eaten. He took some of the remnants of their food with their permission, ate it, and that was very powerful. That purified him. And the result of their blessings, was that the nature of their hearts became attractive to him. Their way of thinking became attractive to him. And this is what association does to us. When I was in high school, I had a friend whose father he used to go to the racetrack and bet on horses all the time. And the boy, what else could he become? So he was also completely addicted to going to the race. And this is in high school, just a kid. So he was doing this, and he was always showing me, look at this horse and this jockey and this horse and this jockey and this and that. And because he was my friend, I also became interested in racehorses. And I used to know this horse and that horse and this jockey and that jockey. I gave it up, by the way. But I once went to the racetrack, though. So I once went, and I lost $2. But who one associates with and who we're close with, there's an exchange of heart, exchange of qualities, exchange of desires. It's just natural. So if one, as Narada Muni, the little boy did, associated with these holy people, there was an exchange of desires, and they blessed him, and through that, the channel of their blessing, their desires naturally, not by zzz, but naturally entered his heart. And their nature, what they liked, what their taste was in life, became attractive to this little boy. Their very nature became it, and that's what we want. Then it's not force. It's spontaneous and natural, and it comes from association and blessings, we could say. So he heard them. They would sit together because they were saintly. They would sit, and what would they talk about? Not racehorses, not this, not that. Their consciousness, their hearts were pure and open to the absolute truth. So this was their taste. It wasn't forced. This is what it means to be saintly. This was their taste. And because they had that taste, they were talking to each other all the time about these things and chanting. And Narada Muni, I mean, the boy before he was the great saint, Narada Muni, he was there because he was serving them. And he heard it. He heard their talking with a mood. Like what you know, you've had this experience when someone's very excited about something and they really are into something, and we hear them talking about it. The enthusiasm and that they have is transferred to us. So the enthusiasm that they had was transferred to him, and it increased day by day, step by step. And gradually, he himself, although a young boy, became strong and fixed. And he understood his ignorance, his own ignorance. In other words, he became humble. He understood his ignorance, and he understood his cause, the cause of his ignorance, the cause of him being covered by so many presuppositions, by so many desires, chasing after so many things that don't at all bring happiness. He could see this. He was introspective. He saw this in himself. He was able to watch his own consciousness, which is what being introspective means. He was able to observe these things in himself, his own ignorance, his own faulty desires, his own pride, his own arrogance, his own anger, his own fears. Even though he was a young boy. And he understood that he was different from all these movements of his mind. He saw himself as different from all these wild thoughts that come and go, the up and the down and the fear and the desire and the hate and the anger and the greed and the this and the envy and the elation, the inflation. He saw himself as different. And he saw the Supreme Absolute Truth. And that both he and that absolute truth were beyond this ever-shifting, changing, subtle, and gross material world and material energy. He actually began to see this. He was gentle. You have to be gentle to have subtle realizations like this. He was gentle. And by serving, his desires became, material desires became completely diminished. And as he tasted the sweetness of their consciousness, which was being transferred to his consciousness, his faith naturally grew, and his senses, eyes, ears. He wasn't always running to do and to touch and to smell and to taste and to became peaceful. And he decided basically, you could say, to imitate them or follow in their example, their footsteps. So no difficulties, right? But the difficulties will soon begin. So they were very kind. But the 4 months of the rainy season ended. And it was time for him to go. Them to go. He naturally wanted to go with them. But how could he go? He was dependent on his mother, and his mother was dependent on him. But before they left, they spoke to him about some... The word used here is some very confidential, more or less very secret, rarely revealed truths. And our Prabhupada in his commentaries explains these truths in one way, and some of our teachers, acharyas, explain it, the confidential truth spoke to them in a little bit of a different way. And I'd like to quickly, very quickly, there's one other file, Premananda, that says the four truths. No, it says the verses.
Yes, that's
the okay.
The empty verses.
Okay. Good, let's see what... Here's the first one. Aham eva sameva gre nanyad yad sadasat param paschar aham yiretat cha yo vishaseet tisosmiham. So first, Krishna is speaking this, and he says, this is the first of the confidential truths, secret truths. And these four are the entirety of the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a huge, so many of these fat books like this in size. This is the whole thing. Very concisely spoken. So this means that Krishna says that the absolute truth, I, and he uses the word aham, which means I, 1, 2, 3 times in the verse. He's saying I existed before the creation. I will exist after the creation. And during the time when this existence is manifested, nothing is different from me. There's nothing separate from the absolute truth, and the absolute truth literally means absolute, everything is included within it. And he says, aham, I, personal. There's nothing separate. That means, in one sense, I'm jumping a little ahead here, even the difficulties are not separate from him. And even ourselves, even we, although we'll hear in the next verse, in illusion, what most of us feel and why we so long to have a deep, deep relationship with someone. And we see this with people, if they have no one in their lives, what do they get?
Dogs.
Either a dog or a cat.
Or a ferret.
Some people get pythons. We need relationship. We're longing for that. But the relationship that we're really longing for, that will really fill the heart, is with this absolute truth, which is, and that relationship is already there. We just need to turn from having our back to it, towards it, like say right now, let's see if we can do this. Oh, I see the cow. But how does it feel to have my back turned towards you all? Isn't it something very disturbing about it? What do you think? Even though we're just playing, isn't it disturbing when someone turns their back to you? So we have to take our turn from our back. In Sanskrit, the word is bahirmukh, or also Bangla, is from bugging him, from having our face turned from the absolute truth and turning towards that absolute truth, because the relationship is already there. That's the first truth, that there's nothing in existence other than Krishna. Next, I'll skip over the English because... Go on, next. Then the second one is Retairi Tam Yad Pratyate Na Pratyajamani Yad Vidvara May Om Mayam Yatoba Shoh Yatatama. And if you see anything as if it's separate, this is illusion. This is what defines illusion, or in Sanskrit, Maya. To see anything as separate, and it's and Yatoba Shoh Yatatama. That means that it's like if there's a mirror and you see the reflection of the apple in the mirror, to think that the apple is in the mirror, it's not. There's a reality and there's a reflection. To see anything separate from the absolute truth is a reflection. It's not reality. It's caused by illusion. Next. Go on to the next Sanskrit. Now this one is the trickiest one of them all, of these four. Itamahanti bhutani bhutetu chesvaches shanu pravastani pravastani tatatesu natesvaham. This means that just as the elements exist, the great quantity of elements like air, or say earth, is the simplest example, that earth exists everywhere, but it also exists here and here and here and here in different forms. So as the elements exist outside of everything and also in everything, similarly, I exist outside of everything, but also in everything. Now, what is going to cause this realization that we're hearing about, which is quite theoretical in one sense, to come to the heart, to actually realize it? And the answer to that is prema, or love. That if one actually has love for the Absolute Truth, for Krishna, then when one sees anything at all, one will see the beloved in that thing, because the beloved is not absent from that. It's just that our illusion that makes us think of it. So it's love that will do everything, and love is the goal, prema. And an example is that when the parents see the shoes of their children, they don't just see shoes. When I see those same shoes, I just see, why has this child left the shoes right in front of my door like that? Or I want the child to see the shoes everywhere. But when the mother or father sees those same shoes, due to their loving relationship, they see their child, basically. And they think of their child when they see that. And their hearts feel so much happiness. So similarly, when relationship is there, a non-illusioned relationship is there, then one sees everywhere this absolute truth, Krishna, who is everywhere. And then finally, the last of these four verses, that you can define things directly or indirectly. So vyatarek means you can find that this is not black, it is not green, it is not purple, it is not orange. Or you can define it directly. Anvayo is direct, vyatarek is indirect. So anvaya means it is white, the positive, what it is directly and what it's not. So when you're looking for truth, you can define the truth directly or indirectly. It is not this, it is not this, it is not this, or it is this. So what this verse is explaining, that you can search and search for the absolute truth, you can define it negatively what it's not. You can define in the path of Gyan, of Dvaita Gyan, I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not that, I'm not this thought, I'm not that thought, I'm not this thought, I'm not that thought, I'm not my mind, I'm not my intelligence, I'm not this concept, not that concept, that's negative. Or positive, what I am, I'm eternal. I'm eternally a servant, I'm eternal. So you can look positively or negatively, but these other truths, these three truths about the existence of the Supreme Lord in everything, Krishna's existence in everything, and the process of finding it, finding that through love, there's no truth higher than this, no matter how you look. That's the fourth truth. This is what is to be achieved through the process of self-realization. So then, after explaining these four truths to this little boy, they left. They went on their way. They had their duties to do. They had their life to live. And there was this boy who loved them, but left without them. Now, what is he going to do? What's going to happen to him? That we will find out next week. Oh. but even though we should end now, because the next program begins at 6, but I wanted to just show you one more thing. There's a little video. Now, raise your hand if you've been to India. Oh, that's almost everyone. Raise your hand if, when you think of your presuppositions about India, what your concepts are about India, whether you've been or not, then there's a little video here. It's only a minute and a half, but I wanted to show you and see where your mind goes and what concepts come to your mind. But we need a little sound in this one. It's going to be over almost right after it starts. You have to watch closely and pay full attention. Breathe first. Sound up. Some of you may be able to recognize where it is. No sound? Okay.
Nasti Vanyo. Pan Sanyo.
Thank you.
someone who's never been to India, what did he think?
Not many people.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
It's quite beautiful.
Yeah.
As you worship.
Thank you.
Old and been modern with the car.
Yeah, thank you. Anyone else?
Can be the visualization I have. It is what you see in the movies. Say, for example, the movie that was made of these British people going to the Marigold Hotel, for example.
Never saw that one myself, but.
and the other one was the one that really made India come alive, or, you know, out there in the movie world, was it was related to this selling of this man collecting, evil man collecting and taking out eyes and everything for transplant.
Ooh.
You remember? No, it was
Slumdog Millionaires. Well, yeah. Well,
and
so see how. Okay, what? Who else has never been to India? What did you see? What struck you? What? Yes.
I thought it was peaceful.
Yeah.
Holy, the temples
and the back. Yeah. Did anyone think, oh, the people in India are so poor, they walk around without shoes, they can't afford shoes?
Somebody was conversing that popped into my head when I saw it. Yeah, it looks very, you know, they don't look well off, like, it's not all pristine or anything, but it looks beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone else?
Free-roaming cows.
Free-roaming cows.
Love that.
But it's so interesting that we'll also, anyone, okay, anyone, what did you see? Anyone who's been to India or whatever, what did you see? In one sentence. Yeah.
Simple,
yes. Anyone else?
Vibrancy,
yes.
Spirituality is important.
Say again?
Spirituality and worship is important.
Yes, anyone else?
Two different cultures.
Okay. Anyone else?
Poverty.
Huh?
Poverty.
Poverty. Look at these poor people. They're selling bananas on the street.
Spontaneity.
See, we're all bringing our own thoughts. And so in one sense, we're seeing our own minds. Whatever we see, we're really seeing so much of it as our own minds. Of course, there is objective reality. But what we perceive is not objective reality, because actually we never could perceive objective reality, but that's a different class. What we're seeing so much has to do with what the presuppositions and their ideas in our own minds. And if you have love for Krishna deeply embedded, that's what you'll see. You'll see everywhere you look. That was one of the messages there. Okay, so we shall end here. If anyone has any questions, I'll sit out there and have some. So we want to allow for the kirtan. And you could, if you want, you can go outside and breathe. There's air available. And thank you so much. Thank you so much.
So, from the bottom of our hearts and from everyone, we'd like to thank Burujan for one story, one truth, part one.
Oh, we missed the second truth.
We did.
Okay. Okay, well, it's there. Believe me, it's there.
I saw it momentarily.
Yes.
Really?
It must be for next week.
You're going to say that it's really supposed to come now. Truth one, truth two. Life's challenges should be viewed through the lens of transcendental knowledge. In other words, this knowledge that you get, that you hear, it's not just to memorize or book knowledge, but it's like a lens. A lens to view the world. We'll speak more about that next time. Okay.
One story, two truths so far.
So far. Oh, please come next time. Yes. I want to have fun.
Please do join us next week.
We'll tell different jokes.
Please do join us next week as we continue the journey. Our journey tonight also continues. Every Saturday, we have our gathering for the Wisdom Tree, which starts in about 20 minutes, so you're just on time. You can have a little break, as Bruton said, you're welcome to go out in our beautiful property, some fresh air, and we'll be rearranging things a little bit here to get ourselves set up. But we'll be starting with some more chanting from 6 o'clock, and then we'll have another talk as well coming up, and then some wonderful food a bit later on. So if you're able to stay, please come back. If you can't, we understand. But we look forward to your company for part 2 next Saturday at 4 o'clock. Thank you.
Thank you.